Hi, this is Tom Zoller, creator of Long Distance Love and Capes, and best known for creating anybody for Dial H for Hero in Superboy number 35. And you are listening to the Quarter Bin Podcast.
This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 123rd episode of The Quarter Bin, we're wrapping up our little mini-series here for the summer. We're calling it Dial Q for Quarter Bin. And for this episode, part 4 of the mini-series, we're looking at Adventure Comics 490, featuring Dial H for Hero, from DC Comics, cover dated February 1982. If you're not familiar with the concept of Dial H, where have you been the last 3 episodes? Or at least unfamiliar with this iteration of it, let me fill you in from the first page of this issue. Christopher King, Victoria Grant. When these two ordinary teenagers found the mystic dials, they had no idea that when they dialed the letters H-E-R-O, they would be turned into the greatest superheroes of all time. Now you can join them and help our titanic twosome dial H for Hero. Now what they meant by that, by the you can join them and help part, is that all of the heroes that Chris and Vicky turn into are based on reader submissions of designs and characters. Many, I think all, of the villains also fit into this category, as do some of the outfits and general clothing that the characters wear, or even, spoilers, the furniture that's in their house. Anytime one of these listener-submitted creations appears in the story, that will be pointed out. And think about that. Those folks, mostly kids, but not always, worked hard on their craft, on their creations. The least that we can do here is give them a podcast shout-out, only, you know, 3.5 decades later. Now this issue, Adventure Comics 490, unlike the other issues we've covered, has only one story in it, and we're not going to have any guests this time. I know. I'm going to miss them too. But first, using a term coined by Sir Martin of Grey, let's dial F for feedback. We heard from Dr. Ange, who said last episode was an excellent review of another strange trip into the world of Dial H. A nice mix of bizarre power sets and names. Of course, Tsunami ended up being used in the Young All-Stars. And I love the idea of Queen of Hearts teaming up with Marvel's Jack of Hearts for an inter-company crossover. Ange continues, by the way, the Hasty Pudding is the name of Harvard's theatrical groups. So I hear the term fairly often up around in these parts. I've never eaten the actual pudding, although it sounds like pure New England fare. Now, I am going to say that I was at least close in my understanding of Hasty Pudding, at least, sort of. As for the idea of me stealing a healing unicorn to aid my medical career, it sounds bad on a couple of levels. First, I have seen Ridley Scott's Legend. Stealing unicorn horns seems to lead to ruin. But more importantly, I refer you to the story of the Kryptonian Nam-Ek, who steals a healing horn and becomes the loneliest man in the universe. It's just not worth it. Ange said also that he was upset that we left out a few of his Jelly Woman puns from the episode. But seriously, Ange, naming the matriarch of the team Marmalade? It's just that you're better than that. That's all. Ange also complimented Sir Martin of Grey for being his usual marvelous self. Sir Martin thanked me for editing him to eliminate his you knows, but trust me, I spent a lot more time cleaning up my own stumbles, repeats, and ums. Now, we all poked at Sean Ross a couple times about his comments about Dial H submissions from adults, and Nathaniel Wayne decided to pile on Sean and me as well. Just caught up on the two most recent installments of Dial C for Cheapskate. Oh, wait, that was the better name that I came up with. Yes, Nathaniel, that is in fact true. Fun listening as always. I don't have a ton to add on the contents of the issue themselves that I didn't already say when I commented the first time around. However, like others before me, I'm going to take a cheap shot at Sean Ross. Normally, I'm not one to pick on your guests, but considering how hard he went after the contributors to the comic who were beyond their teens, I think he deserves a bit of fun ribbing. Oh, and before I get there, Professor, you need to be careful about hiding behind the, well, I was just letting him talk because he was the guest excuse. Yeah, ask Billy Bush how well that turns out. Actually, Nathaniel, I think that's a worse insult to Sean, because if I'm Billy Bush, then he's... Okay, that was admittedly petty, even for me, but meant in the spirit of jovial fun. But seriously, we shouldn't be pulling rank with the sadness of our respective geekdoms. Keep up the good work. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne. That's a good point at the end there, Nathaniel. It all comes down to our various levels of pathos. And in the interest of giving equal time for a rebuttal, here are Sean's comments. First, I didn't realize my "it's kind of strange when adults submit to Dial H" idea was going to be so controversial. He added, "no judgment on those that submitted. The world needs weirdos." Then I added again, "he's not really judging, just goofing around. I host a Secret Wars 2 podcast. I don't get to sit in judgment." The generous Canadian Rob Lance said it was good catching up and talking and being part of the show and sharing the episode with Martin, who said he was chuffed to appear with Rob. And by the way, just to clarify, chuffed is a good thing, at least in Scottish. The kind and friendly Darren Sutherland from the Rad Adventures Network were also kind enough to chime in. "I really enjoyed the episode. Great guests and fun conversation. Dr. Ange ideas for characters and the pun-filled taglines got my morning commute off to a good start. It was good to hear Rob's, Martin's, and the professor's thoughts on these adventures. Great episode. Enjoyed the conversation." Thank you, Darren. It's always good to hear that you and or Ruth are listening to an episode. That episode received social media love from the people mentioned above and Jared Albrecht, the yard sale artist, Coffee and Comics, I Was Joe, Deadshot Dookie, Robert Ludwig, Christopher J. Warden, Professor Mark D. White, comic scholar Jennifer DeRoss, Old School Ross, no relation, Nicholas Prom of Comic Reflections, artist Lauren Skinkus, Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace, Justice's First Dawn, Slang Word Scott, Comics in the Golden Age, Jason Marcinet of the Comic Sans YouTube show, Jason Pickering, The Long Box of Darkness, Gene Hendricks of The Hammer Strikes, Al Sedano, Chris from Bat Books for Beginners, Waiting for Doom, Tim Price, The Comic Connection Store, Too Dangerous for a Girl, and Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower One. Thank you all for that social media support. So let's take a break here, play a promo, and when we come back, we'll talk all about Adventure Comics 490.
In 1915, the world went to war. Nations in Europe met across muddy fields in a conflict that stretched across empires, across the world. This is in history books. John Adams' story of the First World War is found in the letters he wrote back home to his mother. John Adams' Letters from the Front podcast presents these letters 100 years after they were written. Follow John Adams' story through joining the army, training and deployment on the Western Front, through his hopes and fears, frustrations and injuries. We see the personal side of a global conflict. You can find John Adams' Personal Journey podcast every month on johnadams.org.uk/letters or on iTunes under John Adams Letters from the Front podcast. These are his words, read by his grandchildren and narrated by his great-grandchildren.
And we're back. Adventure Comics 490, at a cover price of 60 cents, meaning I acquired this book at an average enough 59% discount off that full list price. The cover of Adventure Comics 490 by the great George Perez and Bob Smith shows a large black figure who seems to be made up of space and planets and stars, and we have some characters flying through this being. Into the abyss, the cover proclaims, and out again into madness. This is the fourth of these covers we've talked about, and my comments remain pretty much the same. When you have no recognizable characters in your title, the action on your cover has to be bold, has to be wild, has to be, well, by definition, attention-getting. And this big, stories-tall character made up of outer space is attention-getting. And therefore, Messrs. Perez and Smith, job well done. This is one long story broken into three chapters with changes in the creative team. So we'll mention where the chapter breaks are, but we'll analyze this as one long story, which it is. Chapter 1 is Into the Abyss by E. Nelson Bridwell, with art by Carmine Infantino and Larry Malstead. We start outside a jewelry store in Fairfax, where Vicky Grant has assumed the identity of Tempest, created by David Hoffman, age 14, Tucson, Arizona. She's using her lightning bolts to capture the squid, created by Lester English, age 31, Chaplin, Kansas. Oh, don't tell Sean Ross that he's 31 years old. The squid uses his ink to escape, and he runs towards his partner, the large cosmic being from the cover, who is the Abyss. Created by Robert A. Bluth, age 21, Elmont, New York. Come, squid, the female is clearly troublesome. And as all of us males who have an older sister can attest, yes, that is true. Abyss opens a portal to their villainous hideout, which closes before Vicky can jump in. Christopher arrives then as Radar Man, credited by David Elia, age 22, Sheboygan, Michigan. They talk about the man-sized hole in space, the living space warp, and Radar Man is able to locate the Abyss and teleports himself there. Tempest uses her hair to create a tornado and travels there as well. Vicky creates a blizzard to blind the squid, while Radar Man pulls a Scooby-Doo, pulling off the squid's mask, only to find that he is really Old Man Smithers, who used to work at the mine before it was abandoned. No, really, actually, he's an alien. After turning in the squid to police, the kids return to the hideout and see the Abyss unfolding himself from space. They turn into Stuntmaster, created by Martin Walsh, age 11, Santa Clara, California, and Starburst, created by Heloise Doucette, age 13, Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. Their powers have no effect on the being, and Stuntmaster, Chris, drives right into the void. Starburst, Vicky, tries to pull him out, but they are both pulled into the being. In the instant Starburst is within the weird landscape, the Abyss folds in again and vanishes. This leads us to Chapter 2, The Other Side of Nowhere, written by the Answer Man, Bob Razakis, with art by Howard Bender and Rodan Rodriguez. Stuntmaster wonders where in the world, or out of it, he's ended up. He is grabbed by large metal clamps, but changing back to the younger, smaller Chris King lets him escape. But then he runs into a small, impish sort of fella, chomping a cigar and shuffling a deck of cards between his hands. This is Black Jack the Death Dealer, created by Stefan DiStefano, age 15th, Ozone Park, New York. He tells Chris this is his casino and throws a roulette wheel at the kid. Chris surreptitiously dials up another hero, this time Shadow Master, created by Stefan Berzawecki, age 15, Winnipeg, Manitoba, another Canadian submitter. I hope Rob Lance is paying close attention to this episode. His country mates are dominating the episode. Shadow Master whips up a moving cloud of darkness to cover his hasty exit. But as Shadow Master reaches for one of the curtains, he's grabbed by Blackjack. Normally, Chris would try to fight his way out of whatever superhero guise he had. But here, in the void, it's timeless. And that lets me keep redialing. So exit Shadow Master and enter Centaurus, Master of Vibration, created by David T. Satterley, age 15, Meadville, Pennsylvania. He absorbs the vibrations from Blackjack's shuffling cards and vibe blasts the curtain away. But that only reveals a blank wall. There is no escaping my casino of death, Blackjack tells him, and Chris knows he has to play along. So Centaurus takes a card. But Chris isn't the only one who flew into the abyss. We join Starburst, who instantly knows this isn't the place she saw Chris fall into. She falls into some disgusting muck, but luckily she has the power to propel herself out. Hold, creature, she hears, as a green lizard being introduces himself as the Serpent, created by Joseph Harding, age 20, Portland, Oregon. She uses her flight power and star-powered eye bursts, whatever those are, to free herself from grabbing vines that seem to be screeching at her in pain. What kind of strange place is this, she wonders, not realizing that just then her 60 minutes of starburst are up and Vicky Grant falls from the sky. Meanwhile, somewhere else, Centaurus draws the Ace of Spades, the death card, as Blackjack likes to call it. Too bad, you lose. But he won't give up without a fight. I've got to gamble my own way and hope that the next hero I dial up will be better in a fight. And he becomes Deflecto, created by Darren Hackenbrook, age 16, another Canadian. This one from Mattawa, Ontario. Blackjack fires coins from a pair of slot machines at him, but Deflecto repels them all because of his deflection powers. Blackjack is impressed and offers him another double or nothing bet. And just as he grabs for another card, we move somewhere else, where Vicky crashes back into the swampy muck. She uses a vine to pull herself out so she can hide for an hour before dialing herself up another heroin. And elsewhere, Chris King has no such time limits to restrict his hero dialing. Receiving another death card, the Ace of Spades again, he dials it again and becomes Worm Man, created by Robbie Halverson, age 15, Grand Forks, North Dakota. I have all the powers of a superworm, he says to himself. Sorry, I can't read that without laughing. Including the ability to eat my way through the ground. Okay. Blackjack accuses him of cheating, but Worm Man does manage to escape the little imp. Back in the other elsewhere, enough time has passed for Vicky to turn into Spinning Jenny, created by yet another Canadian, Paul Spidel, age 19, Winnipeg, Manitoba. This is exactly why we needed NAFTA. Let's see how your vine can hold a woman who spins like a top. The Serpent wants to know about the secret of her powers, but she manages to spin herself away up into the air and away from him. And then there is nothing in the sky above the swamp world of the serpent. And back on a world without time, Wormman pops out of the ground on a dark, deserted landscape. This place looks like a cross between Death Valley and a half-empty jar of peanut butter. As swiftly as he can dial, Chris King changes form once, twice, numerous times, becoming one hero after another. Spectro, created by Eric Mann, age 14, Lakeville, Minnesota. And then, Airmaster, created by Stephen M. Solomon, age 15, Worcester, Mass. And then The Sting, created by Kevin Flaherty, age 16, Irmo, South Carolina. And The Attacker, created by Kurth Kost II, age 15, Brown Deer, Wisconsin. All of those folks, by the way, are introduced in the same long panel. Until he becomes Galaxy, created by Brett Ziegler, age 16, from Fresno, California. Finally, I have the ability to travel to another world and then return to Earth. He travels to a new place, and Spinning Jenny slows down, shimmering into sight. Chris, is that you? Who else? Though I have been through more characters than I can describe since I last saw you. I guess Abyss took off after sending us to these crazy places, Vicky answers. They decide to change back. It's not bad being super people, but it's nice to get back to being themselves. They look around for clues to signs of the Abyss reappearing so they can get back home. Which brings us to Chapter 3, Battle of the Abyss. And for this one, we're back to the creative team from the first chapter of Bridwell, Infantino, and Malstead. Nearby, the Squid and Abyss figure out the next steps in their evil plan, but the kids overhear it. So they turn into Scylla, created by Bill Mimbu, age 21, Bellevue, Washington, and Topsy Turvy, created by David Weil, age 18, Nova Scotia, Canada. Now, David is our most productive Canadian yet, because he also created the Marionette from last issue. Scylla has six mechanical arms with heads at their ends. The original Scylla was a nymph turned into a six-headed monster. She, hero explains to the Squid, she used to pluck sailors off ships, just as I'm going to pluck the sucker fingers right off your gloves. I know, I find it hard to believe that somebody typed that sentence as well, but there you go. Topsy Turvy removes the Abyss's sense of orientation and direction. You don't know whether you're coming or going. In a cool full-page spread, we see various versions of the Abyss, different colors and shapes. You've lost touch with reality, Chris tells him. How can you fight us when you can't keep anything straight? The Squid jumps into the Abyss to get back home, but his fading screams indicate that just maybe things didn't go so well for him. The Abyss himself folds in a way the kids haven't seen before. And then, in a burst of light, he's gone. I wonder if he just went somewhere, Vicky wonders. Or if he died. They dial themselves back to normal, and Chris finally returns home. Somehow. His dad is excited to show him their new furniture. Designed by John H. Costello Jr., age 24, Edwards, California. The delivery of the furniture was pretty exciting for the Kings, let me tell you. See what you miss when you stay out so long? His mom asks, and his brother adds that he missed out on all the excitement. If you only knew, little brother, Chris thinks in the final panel. If only you knew. The end. So as my podcasting contemporary, Trennis Magnus, likes to say, what did I think of this? Wow. A novel-length story, as they used to say. And they kept the action going well enough to fill all those pages. And even though the plot had more holes in it than the character of Abyss had portals, I still dug it. And there was some solid art towards the end of the story. We joked with Sean Ross a few episodes back about the number of characters Razakis put in one of his stories, and here, there must have been another bet involved, or the inbox was getting so stuffed he felt he had to empty it completely out. Because it's crazy how many characters are in here, and there's some nice furniture designs as well. Lots and lots of readers getting their due, getting their shout-outs, and that is what this comic is all about. That is the key aspect, the distinctive of this book. Now, it must be a fun challenge for a writer to have all these characters and have to work them all into a sense of reasonably, a sort of sense, a story that can pass for sensible. Let's put it that way. And overall, I think it was good work. So, all right, let's move right into the key parts of our issue analysis here as we dial Q for Quarterbin. We have 20 listener submissions to consider, and that's not even counting the furniture. As you all know by now, we're looking at three different characters here. First, favorite name of a character. And since I didn't have a guest on this episode, I let you, the lovely listeners, choose this one. I ran a series of Twitter polls to judge your favorite choice for a character name. What I did was eliminate my own least favorite four, leaving 16, and I ran four polls with four names each, and then ran those four winners against each other. And the listener choice for favorite name of a character from this entire issue was Shadow Master. And that's a solid name. It would be near the top of my name. It would be on my list of top names as well. It was pretty good. And I feel bad about this now, but I did not include Worm Man on my list. That was one of the ones that I eliminated. I know it probably would have won the entire election, whether the Russians hacked it or not. But there certainly was a variety of names here. You had the traditional ones with man in the name. Worm Man, Radar Man. One word names started with the Sting, the Squid, the Attacker. And ones that were registered trademarks like Starburst. I did kind of like Deflecto as a name. It's dumb, it's silly, but it's accurate and easy to pronounce. Now, there was a lot of pushback against Centaurus, which may have been trying to be too clever for its own good, combining Centaur and Taurus. I personally thought Scylla was okay, but needed the teammate of Charybdis to be a real top-level candidate. But let me say, I do approve of the name Shadowmaster as our favorite for the issue. Personally, I think the listeners did a fine job. But not every listener felt that their fellow listeners did such a good job. We had two write-in votes for a candidate eliminated in the first round. And one of those voters decided to give a stirring stump speech in favor of his preferred candidate, which is one of the great advantages of being the reigning listener of the year. Isn't it, Dr. Ange?
Thank you, Professor Allen, for giving me this opportunity to address your audience. You know, sometimes I lose faith in the comic book community, whether it's the excesses of the extreme 90s or the violence of DC's New 52. I sometimes wonder whether or not this medium has a future. And maybe those concerns were softening a bit with the optimism of DC's rebirth, but I was once again smacked in the face with my doubts. And believe it or not, it started with a Twitter poll you had, where you asked people to vote for the best superhero name. One of the choices was Spinning Jenny, which seemed the perfect superhero name. After all, the best superhero names have some inkling into the person's powers and sometimes have a nice little play on words to make things even better. And Spinning Jenny just seemed the height of perfection to me. And yet, somehow, Centaurus One, which seems like a horrible name. I mean, Spinning Jenny is named after a weaving device, some sort of sewing machine apparatus from early history, where you had multiple different threads meshing together into one sort of unit. And that's great, because spinning Jenny has one definition and could be applied to the superhero. And I would imagine that this would be some sort of super speed person, maybe somebody that spins to create vortexes or things like that. And I was on board. But I was let down. And so I'm here to appeal one more time for Spinning Jenny. I mean, I think it sells itself. Picture, if you will. From ancient times, the Greek Fates, those mystic weavers of destiny, have tasked a mortal to be their instrument on Earth. From generation to generation, a family's loom is imbued with power, able to grant its user great speed and stamina. That ability to rush in and intercede in events to make sure that the tapestry of life remains unsnarled and perfect. And so, when Jennifer Katsourgradakis uses her family's ancient loom, she is transformed into a being surging with deific energies. She becomes the Ancient of the Gods, the spectacular sower of super speed. She becomes Spinning Jenny. Don't miss her first adventure, A Stitch in Time, in Spinning Jenny number 1, coming out this September. So awesome, you won't believe it. I mean, that sells itself. So, I'm hoping that I can intercede and remove Centaurus from whatever awful discussion you are having about him, and put Spinning Jenny back into the mix. Signing off, Dr. Ange.
I will neither agree nor disagree with Ange, but I will defend his right to hold unusual opinions and to express those unusual opinions. Because remember, the right to free speech for others does mean that sometimes you will hear things you don't quite agree with. But I think we can all agree that the ER patients of New England are lucky to have such a passionate and engaged man caring for their emergency medical needs. I do need to address one character here as well. Do you remember our conversation with Sean Ross where we talked about the character of Ragnarok, but he wasn't just Ragnarok? He was Ragnarok, the Cosmic Viking. Well, here I put Blackjack on those Twitter polls, and he made it into the finals and ended up tied for second, not that many votes behind Shadowmaster. I wonder if I'd given his full name, Blackjack the Death Dealer, maybe he could have won. Because even though Blackjack the Death Dealer doesn't really make sense, like it's two different versions of the word deal, I think. But then again, Cosmic Viking doesn't make a lot of sense either. So I just wanted to give Blackjack the Death Dealer his due by giving him his full name. Now, in terms of favorite costume, this is where the most subjectivity comes in. And if you remember my conversation with the very Natalie attired Scotsman Sir Martin of Grey, sometimes my taste in clothes and outfits might be a little out there. I do count it as one of my greatest achievements that while the show What Not to Wear was in production on TLC, I was never nominated to be on the show. That and staying off Hoarders, Clean Sweep, and more recently Live PD, staying off of all of those shows, like I said, that's a great personal achievement. Since there are so many characters in this one, 20 if I didn't mention that already, I'm going to split them into Vicky, Chris, and villains. For Vicky, we start off with an interesting one, Tempest, which is a standard purplish-type suit with a boob window, it must be said, but the cool part is her hair. When we meet her, it's piled up on her head in the shape of a dark storm cloud, and it's huge. We also see her have green misty hair, spinning whirlwind hair, and white icy hair. So I guess that's actually a combo of design and powers, actually. Starburst isn't bad either for her. Long, yellowy-orange pants, orange hair, and stars all over the costume. The branding is very strong with that one. That one might be my favorite, although, don't tell Ange. The orange and black of Spinning Jenny, that's not too bad either. For Chris, he has way more because he has the scene where he rolls through like five characters in two panels. Of those, Sting isn't bad. Green stripes and wings and yellow, not bad. The black and white of Galaxy is very good, but I'm going with a more traditional hero look, that of Radar Man. A green bodysuit, yellow boots, belt, glove, and cape. Yellow headpiece with awesome green goggles and a green fin. There's no reason to think that it's an homage to Adam Strange, but it makes me think of the Rannian hero, and that's good enough for me. The villains in this issue are among the better creations, I think. I did want to give shout-outs again to Blackjack the Death Dealer, a very short person chomping on a cigar with a diamond-tipped walking stick. Very classic. And lastly, to the extent that it's revealed what's the best power set of these characters. Well, again, Chris goes very quickly through a bunch of his iterations, so it's sort of hard to tell exactly what those characters' powers were. Our main villain, Abyss, is actually pretty hard to beat here. The ability to transport you to a variety of weird and creepy worlds. And I give Bridwell credit for taking the character of Worm Man and figuring out how to use him for a few pages. It does make you wonder how Worm Man got a few pages, got actual scenes and actions, while Spectro and Airmaster and the Sting and the Attacker, they all had to share a single panel and didn't do anything other than pose and then get changed into something else. With a few of those, I do kind of understand, actually. And don't tell Ange. But Spinning Jenny, she kind of gets it done with her powers, too. Now, overall, do I really care that the reveal of the alien in the first part of the story doesn't really go anywhere? Or that the kids, after having undialed themselves, seem to walk out of Abyss's dimension right to their own homes? Or that the Death Dealer seems to only have one card in his deck, the Death card? I mean, I guess that kind of goes with the name. But that card doesn't really have a lot of effect on the character who draws that card? So do I care that I don't care about any of those things in this comic nearly as much as I would if it were any other comic, costing 25 cents or not, that had the same gaping holes in them in terms of the plot? Do I care that I'm a hypocrite? That there is no real objective reason that I should adore these Dial H stories as much as I do? No. No. I don't care. I had an absolute blast reading this absolutely silly and absolutely insane tale. The verdict on Adventure Comics 490, despite a few minor plot holes, I have to say, yes, a quarter bin deal. And at 20 new characters in it, for crying out loud, of course, it's a quarter bin deal. Now, if you're interested in hearing me talk about the rest of the book, I know what you're thinking, but that was a full-length story. Isn't that the whole book? No, 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 no. This comic has other important parts, you know. Non-story parts. You know, the ads. If you want to hear me talk about the ads, you can dial up episode 3 of the new Count Dante's Black Dragon Society podcast. Available on Mike Peacock's Justice's First Dawn podcast feed, where all he does on that show is talk about the ads in comic books. I don't like to throw around words willy-nilly or exaggerate or engage in hyperbole, but that may be one of the most genius ideas for a podcast I've ever heard. That wraps up my coverage of Adventure Comics 490. Bringing episode 1, 2, 3 to a close, and bringing Dial Q for Quarterbin to to a close. It's possible that more Dial H will show up sometime on the podcast down the road, but if so, I think that'll be a long time from now. But next time in episode 124, though we are moving on from Dial Q, we are moving back to a title that we covered not all that long ago. There was such positive feedback for this character, for this title, I thought it was a good idea to head back in her direction. So it's Dakota North 2 and 3, the Marvel Comics cover dated August and October 1986. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Shortbox Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.